Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. The world of fast fashion has complicated clothing production by outsourcing around the world to whoever can sew them the cheapest. And now you, the consumer, are paying the price with rising costs. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. So when you buy from American Giant, you're taking a stand for hardworking people, local communities, and quality clothes. American Giant directly supports American manufacturers and ensures you aren't footing that tariff bill. Support American-made tariff-free clothing with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be rejoined today by Ryan Fonder of the Los Angeles Times. He's got a great newsletter over there. I'll have a link to it in my email. Ryan, of course, has been on the show a bunch of times. We got him on just like 3 months ago. So this is the gap is smaller this time. The gap is smaller this time than last time. You were saying you wanted to be on the show more, and you got it. You got it, buddy.
Closing that the theatrical window, but it said it's for podcasting.
Yeah, we're getting the guest spots more and more. So the reason we're having you on this week is because big news in the world of entertainment. Paramount has been purchased by David Ellison and Skydance, kind of. It's a very complicated stock swap, et cetera, et cetera. And I wanted to get you on here. So it's funny, I do another podcast across the movie aisle. We talked a little bit about this. And at the top of it, I very explicitly said, I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty details of how the money works in this, because frankly, I don't entirely understand it. But I do want to get into that here, because this is what the show does. So Ryan, explain to the people what exactly this deal is. What is David Ellison and Skydance buying? Who are they partnering with to buy it? How do some of the shareholders over at Paramount feel differently about it than Sherry Redstone and her group? What is the actual deal here?
Okay, so depending on how far back you want to zoom out, Paramount Global is the New York-based media company that owns Paramount Pictures. It owns CBS and a bunch of cable assets, including MTV, Nickelodeon, Comedy Central, etc. And that company has been struggling for a really long time because of the deterioration of those TV assets and also the underinvestment in the film studio. So the interesting thing about Paramount Global is that it has two classes of shareholders. One is the B-class shareholders that are just held by regular folks out, you know, trading stock on Wall Street, institutional investors, people like that. And then Shari Redstone, the heir to the late Sumner Redstone, the media tycoon, has 77% control of the voting shares, the voting Class A shares. And she held those shares within a company called National Amusements Inc., or NAI. And that company is basically just a holding company that serves as the controlling shareholder of Paramount Global, and also happens to own a share of movie theater chains they're very regional. Anyway, so in order to take control of Paramount Global, all a company or investor has to do is buy out Shari Redstone's controlling share price. So you could buy 10% of the economic value of Paramount. Doesn't matter. If you own those 77% voting shares, you get to control the company, essentially. So what David Ellison and his backers in the private equity world did, plus, you know, some not insignificant funding from his father, Larry Ellison, they came in and offered $2.4 billion for National Amusements just to take it off of Shari Redstone's hands and allow her to cash out. So they did that deal, And it's a, like you mentioned, it's a complicated deal. So the $2.4 billion, Sherry Roadstone and her family will get about $1.75 billion of that. In addition, Ellison and his backers are setting aside $4.5 billion for the for other shareholders who are not the Redstones. So people who just own the stock or have voting shares but aren't Sherry Redstone can cash out if they want to. And then they're going to inject about $1.5 billion into the balance sheet to improve Paramount's finances, which has been, you know, hobbled by debt and just under investment for years and years and years. And then what happens is that Paramount will give Skydance shareholders a bunch of stock and then have Skydance merge into Paramount Global, thereby, you know, diluting the normal shareholders, but also putting David Ellison and his backers in control of the company. So, as you mentioned, complicated transaction, but they made it work. And the reason Shari Redstone liked this deal, as opposed to other deals that would potentially come through from maybe Sony, Apollo, maybe some other billionaire, was that the whole pitch that David Ellison, Jeff Shell, and his cohorts made was that they would keep these assets relatively intact, keeping them together. Everyone else wanted to buy it. They wanted to sell off the cable assets. They wanted to sell the Melrose Avenue studio lot. Ellison's not interested in doing that. You know, there's a chance that BET gets sold off, and there's going to be a lot of cost cutting, or there's going to be some joint ventures in the interim. But the general idea here is that David Ellison, who's a movie lover and a producer, in addition to being a billionaire son, comes in, buys it, takes control, and then basically keeps it together.
All right, so there's a ton of stuff here. I want to loop back to the stock question just for a second, because there is some, you know, there's a lot of kind of saber rattling from the institutional investors who say we are getting screwed here. We're, you know, you get to take over this whole company and we get like an extra dollar on our share price or whatever, and that's not good enough for us. We need more than that. I'm just curious if there's been any movement on that front, or if there's any real sense of if or when a lawsuit will happen. I mean, I feel like there are still hurdles to overcome beyond whatever regulatory, you know, FCC issues there might be because of the TV stations and all that. There will be some, there are still going to be some kind of lawsuit fights over this as we keep going, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the shareholders are just glad that this is done. To be honest, like that this is going to be, because this was overhanging the company for quite a long time. The long suffering Paramount shareholders have been dealing with the talks of that this was going to happen for 6 months or more. So there's a little bit of a sigh of relief happening. There was a lot of saber rattling, like you said, before the deal actually got signed. Because a lot of shareholders were worried that Sherry Redstone was just going to make off with a huge premium on her controlling shares, and that was going to happen at the expense of regular shareholders. I mean, she's definitely getting a bigger premium on her shares than the regular shareholders are. There's no doubt about it, but there's a reason for that. It's because she controls the company. Nonetheless, she's not the only shareholder who owns voting stock. There's also an investor named Mario Gabelli who owns a not insignificant number of voting shares, who is taking a close look at this deal, requesting documents, making sure that, you know, he's not getting screwed, that regular investors are not getting screwed. So, you know, as far as when, you know, there's still some, you know, these things can't happen immediately, most likely, but, you know, it's definitely something we're looking out for.
Yeah. And now you talked to Jeff Shell, who is going to be taking over as CEO, right?
President
COO?
Is going to be
president.
His...
President. Okay. Oh, yeah. He was formerly NBC Universal, right?
Correct. Yeah, he was the CEO of NBC Universal.
So he's got a lot of experience here. He kind of understands the lay of the land. And it's funny, I was reading some of the transcripts from the from the teleconference that they did with investors and press and everybody. And he made the I think the basic fundamental point of this whole moment of the entertainment industry, which is this. TV, yes, TV channels like CBS are in decline, but they're in slow decline. Linear cable channels are in decline, and they're in very rapid decline. And trying to figure out what to do with that at Paramount is job number one. That's like the thing they have to figure out first.
Yeah, and that makes sense, right? Because not only is linear TV and basic cable in this very steep decline moment, but the Paramount assets are also uniquely ill-positioned. You could argue, like, the MTV brand used to mean a lot to people. It used to be the youth brand for television and cable. That is definitely no longer the case. It hasn't been for a long time. So they have to figure out what's gonna change there. If it's even salvageable. Nickelodeon, yeah, it's still a pretty big name in kids TV, but they have to figure that out. They have to figure out streaming and profitability and cost cutting. And, you know, there's already talk that they're going to sell BET to that unit's CEO. So, yeah, I mean, you can see that's definitely job number one. At the same time, they also are talking a lot. When I talked to Jeff Shell, I asked him specifically if they were going to cut back on the number of movies released for theaters or increase that number of movies. And, you know, one of the things that he said was that Paramount historically has not done a very good job of managing its franchises, of investing in its franchises and its intellectual property. They want to change that. Now, obviously, that is easier said than done, but their goal, or their stated goal, at least at the moment, is more movies in theaters for people to see. So that should at least be a relief to the folks at AMC and the other theater chains.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I read what he had said about Paramount's franchises, and then I started thinking, like, okay, well, what are Paramount's franchises? I mean, there's Star Trek, obviously. Paramount Plus is basically the Star Trek network, sure. You know,
but
then what else is, so it, are they, I mean, that it is technically a franchise. There are two movies, in the series, but like, you know, there's Mission Impossible, right? Which has, there's already a partnership there between Skydance and Paramount and yeah. Mission Impossible. That's
Sonic, you know, the Hedgehog the now has a trilogy or going okay. to be, you know, there's stuff there. Like, the problem is it hasn't been managed very well. I mean, how many shows has Paramount done out of the Taylor Sheridan Yellowstone universe? I mean, sure. One of the original sins of Paramount Plus is that they allowed Yellowstone to go stream through a deal on a rival streaming service at Peacock. So they've tried to correct and maybe overcorrect in certain ways by making a lot of Taylor Sheridan shows for Paramount Plus specifically. And now you've got the, you know, the Taylor verse is what they call it internally. But I mean, one of the things that Jeff Shell said to me when we were on the phone, when this deal closed, was that if you look out on the landscape, there's currently no Top Gun movie, there's currently no Top Gun theme park ride. Like, there's no roller coaster. There used to be a number of them. Like, Paramount, there were Paramount theme parks. That mm-hmm. no longer exists and hasn't for years. So, like, that's what they're talking about in terms of managing franchises better and investing more in them.
Let me tell you, I'm going to get sidetracked here for a second, because I used to live 30 minutes, 40 minutes from Paramount's King's Dominion in Virginia. And that was a great theme park. Paramount's King's Dominion was great. They had all sorts. There was a Italian Job ride that was like you rode in a little mini, little Mini Cooper, and it was like you're going through really tons of fun. And then they got rid of. And I lived near there when they got rid of the Paramount branding, when they sold it to whatever else. And all of the rides went to these. It was the same rides, but they just had to take away all the Paramount branding. So it was like
It was like.
Oh God! What did they change it to? I could probably look it up right now. I'm not going to, but it's
like
something like
blast off, rocket, zoom, plane, coaster,
yeah, no,
or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, it's like
super generic.
Yeah, Paramount's like back, or no, not Paramount. It was like back movie lot heist ride or something. Like legitimately, legitimately, you know, the most generic name that they could come up for it, which you, was
yeah. Was very European funny. Small car race. Yeah, got
exactly,
it.
Exactly. So I there's a thing you mentioned with the Paramount Plus, and I think this is really interesting too, because there does seem to be rumblings of a pivot in the Paramount stable, that they want to do a better job of not walling everything off behind Paramount Plus. That they want to shift to a kind of arms dealer model like Sony has, where they're leasing things to other places and generating revenue that way. Is that and then at the same time they're also saying, but also we're not getting rid of Paramount Plus, we're investing more in it, we want to build the algorithm, we want to get the ads better, we want to blah blah blah. And those two ideas do kind of seem to be in tension.
Yeah, but this is the same thing that Warner Bros. Discovery has done with Max, right? Like, they're taking a lot of their old shows, like Sex and the City, and licensing them out. Like, this walled garden approach has kind of fallen by the wayside for a lot of companies. Like, licensing is back as long as they're, you know, there's IP to mine, and it's old enough where you're not, you know, missing out on anything. Like, for example, I don't think they're not gonna, at Max, they're not going to license House of the Dragon anytime soon to Netflix, because that's a show that's doing really well right now and really driving a big audience. But if you have something old, like, I don't know, just say something like Sex and the City or 6 Feet Under, and I'm using Max examples because that's at the top of my mind right now, like, there's no reason not to license, because that's just revenue coming in. Like, then you don't have to hardly do anything about it. Now, I don't know what this necessarily the parallel is at Paramount, but I do know that they're licensing Dexter for mm-hmm. Netflix right now. That's an old Showtime show, right, that they're actually rebooting for spinoffs and stuff like that for Paramount Plus. Like, that's part of their franchise strategy. And so we'll see. I mean, I'm sure it'll be a mixture. Like, they're not just gonna sell off everything to Netflix and the other streamers, but they will pick and choose.
Yeah, no, I mean, it makes so much sense. I've always thought the walled garden approach was not ideal for a bunch of reasons, but among them being you're just giving up free money. I mean, it's mm-hmm. you know, if something even like Star Trek: The Next Generation or Deep Space Nine or something, there's no reason that needs to be exclusively on Paramount Plus. I mean, I seriously doubt there are people who are subscribing solely for those programs. You know, get them on, get a little extra money from Netflix or whoever by having them over there. The mood around David Ellison and Skydance and Redbird picking up Paramount as opposed to Sony Apollo seem to be I'll put it this way. Everybody I have talked to has said, we love David Ellison. He actually likes movies. It's good to have him run a movie studio. We like that. But the secondary issue here is that it means that there won't be the same sort of merger that there would be with a Sony Pictures and Paramount, as we saw with Warner. I'm sorry, not Warner. 20th Century Fox and Disney, right? There were job losses. There were departments merged. People lost jobs. Lots of jobs went away and are not coming back. And I don't think you're going to have a similar situation with Skydance and Paramount, right?
Well, you will see layoffs, and there will be, you know, they've targeted, they say, $2 billion in cost savings over a certain amount of time. So there will be some dislocation, some job losses for sure, but not the kind of situation that you saw in 2019 with Disney and Fox, where you just basically merged an entire studio out of existence. Like, no one in Hollywood is eager to see something like that. And that's more than likely what would have happened if Sony and Apollo had gotten a hold of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It is tough out there. All right. Any more thoughts on Paramount and David Ellison, your discussion with Jeff Schell? I mean, I think it's fascinating. I think this is it will take a while to unfold entirely, but this is, I think, the best outcome anyone could have hoped for in this situation, right?
Yeah, it's just still very much a wait and see kind of thing. I mean, I remember it was not even that long ago that David Zaslav came to town and talked a big game about being like a Hollywood mogul, and he was celebrated because, you know, he bought Robert Evans's house, and it was like, you know, he cared about movies and theaters and stuff like that. And then things kind of went sideways after that. So we will see. There's always kind of a moment of truth when a new mogul comes to town, freshly minted, and they're like, oh, wait, well, maybe my strategy wasn't so good. The other thing that David Ellison likes to talk a lot about is about improving the technology for Paramount and making it more of a media and technology company than just like a legacy media company, which sounds good on paper and probably looks good on a PowerPoint. But what does that actually mean beyond just improving the recommendation algorithms and making more movies in the cloud and saving money that way? Like, those are all probably good enough ideas, but they're not going to be game changers for Paramount, most likely.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there does seem to be some happy talk there.
Happy talk, yeah.
In terms of what it actually means, you know, to pivot to technology. I don't know. We'll see.
Looking to upgrade your bathroom without the hassle or the wait? Say hello to Blissful Baths, the stress-free way to transform your space into a relaxing retreat. Right now, Blissful Baths is offering 12 months with no payments and no interest. That's right, zero payments and zero interest for a whole year. Even better, they can replace your walk-in shower or bath in as little as one day. No mess, no long waits, just a beautiful new bath space, fast. And here's the cherry on top. You can get up to 20% off with instant manufacturer rebates, plus extra savings for seniors and first responders. Ready to turn your bathroom into your own personal spa? Go to blissfulbaths.com today to request your free consultation. That's blissfulbaths.com. You deserve affordable luxury.
We'll see. All right. Another kind of interesting, less happy, more sad story. Redbox. What happened to Redbox? Because I go to my Kroger now, and every time I go there, I'm greeted with a Redbox that just has a big sign on it that says, "No movies here. Go somewhere else." Basically,
well,
it doesn't quite
well, here's that. A number that you won't. I mean, I couldn't even believe it when I saw it, but apparently, Redbox still had like 24,000 red rental kiosks around the U.S. You know, at the various Walgreens and WalMarts and everything. I almost couldn't believe it. A couple of things have happened with Redbox. I mean, crucially, you know, streaming and online video on demand basically hoovered up the whole market for rentals and all that. And, you know, it's DVDs have just gone so far by the wayside. It's like a classic ice cube theory where it starts melting slowly, and then it just all goes away at once. So, I mean, you even saw with DVDs in the big box retail spaces, like, I think Target has gotten away from selling DVDs in any meaningful way. Best Buy got rid of its DVD sections. The only one really left of any significance was Walmart, and even that seemed to be on kind of shaky ground. So the theory with Redbox was that this company named Chicken Soup for the Soul Entertainment, which of course is related to the Chicken Soup for the Soul brand of books, the publishing, the uplifting stuff, they took over Redbox in 2022. And in so doing, this company took on about $360 million worth of debt in order to do that transaction in the sort of quixotic bet that, you know, after the COVID and the strikes and everything like that, the DVD market would come back, or the DVD rental market would come back, at least to some sort of stability. It didn't. And, you know, it's just kind of everything kind of went haywire, and this whole Chicken Soup for the Soul Entertainment offshoot just declared bankruptcy a couple weeks ago. First Chapter 11. And then when it was pretty clear that things were even worse than people thought, the lenders forced them to go into a Chapter 7 liquidation. So essentially no more Redbox. All those kiosks are going dark. Maybe they'll get sold off to who knows who. And about 1,000 people are now going to be out of work.
Yeah. I mean, it's why that's a number. That's the number of kiosks that was still in operation is a wild number, that 20 some thousand figure, which is just I go to Kroger every week and I see it there and I'm like, I literally never saw anybody use it. And it was always kind of a mystery to me. And I would actually go look at it just because I'd be like, what is in the rental box today? What Bruce Willis straight to DVD or Mel Gibson straight to DVD feature is being advertised to folks today? Because it is an interesting window. Yeah, I was going to say,
like, did they have anything new? I mean,
it was fascinating. It was actually like, I should have written an actual piece about this because it was fascinating. There's this whole alternate universe of straight to DVD, you know, kind of action movies with, you know, Sylvester Stallone comes and shoots for a day and gets paid $1 million and he gets his face on the box and people come rent it because they want to see the new Sylvester Stallone movie. But it's fascinating. But this does get to a broader point about the state of physical media, as we were discussing this a little bit in DMs, which is, you know, the rental market has, as you say, shifted entirely almost to VOD, to digital. People don't, what was it that you said? People don't rent vinyl, right? They buy vinyl.
Yeah.
And
DVDs and Blu-rays are kind of like the new vinyl for visual media.
Well, right, I'm curious. It's always so funny. It's interesting to look at the charts, the breaking down what percentage of disc is being sold. Because even today, still 65% of physical media sold is DVDs. You know, another 20% is Blu-ray, and like 10% is 4K. And it's crazy, these numbers. Which I guess leads to my question here, which is that without a source like Redbox or Blockbuster or Hollywood Home Video or whatever, without that source of mass-produced DVD repositories, whatever you want to call them, can the physical media world even survive? I don't see how it becomes viable to keep the pressing plants running, to keep everything being made if you're not creating a, you know, kind of critical mass of stuff that is being rented. I guess my question, and maybe you don't know the answer, but you can just riff if you would like. I'd be fine with that. But like as somebody who buys a lot of Blu-rays and high def discs, I worry that the collapse of the rental market will be the thing that actually kills the ability to get these things made, because it just won't be profitable anymore.
Well, I mean, those are the discs themselves, the Blu-ray discs, the margins on those are still very, very strong. So as long as there's some audience for it who's willing to, like yourself, just buy, you know, spend, I don't even know how much a Blu-ray costs these days, but it's not cheap. But that's like gravy for the studios. And it used to be a lot more. It is collapsed quite a bit, but there is still a home entertainment business. You know, I go into Barnes & Noble sometimes at the Americana brand, the Caruso Mall in Glendale, and they still have a pretty okay DVD section. It is like very geared toward the film nerd kind of Criterion collection collector mm-hmm. type. Mm-hmm. So y'all are keeping this thing alive. You know, it is that's why I say it is very much like vinyl, because it is the person who really, really cares about having that thing on the shelf on physical media, having the best possible version for it that they can show on their 4K, you know, HD TV. Yeah, that's the market now. And those people just don't rent. And if they are renting, they're doing so through digital. Because, like, why in the world would you drive to a 7-Eleven to pay $2 for a Redbox that you're probably just going to forget about and, like, leave in your car or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's interesting. All right. Let us shift gears to your most recent newsletter on the first half of the box office 2024. What is the lesson? What's the number one takeaway so far, first half of 2024 at the box office?
Well, it's still down. Volume matters. The release slate matters. We are seeing, after a really, really rough May and June, where there just weren't that many good movies out for a mass audience. We are seeing quite a bit of a pickup. Most recently, you had Long Legs, which was this little neon horror movie that just did gangbusters for that type of film. I mean, $22.6 million in an opening weekend for a neon movie that costs less than $10 million to make and market. I mean, that is an impressive number and speaks to the virality of the marketing push and just, you know, the continued interest in this genre and the reliability of this genre and Nick Cage and all that. And you've had a string of pretty well-performing movies, especially in the family and kids space, with Inside Out 2 making, like, this movie's going to make, like, upwards of $1.5 billion or something like that, probably get close. And then Despicable Me 4, and, you know, even movies like the Garfield movie did okay, pretty good. So you're seeing a little bit of a pickup. August is looking light. You know, there's Twisters that's going to come out this weekend and do pretty well, like probably $50 million domestic. August is, it's looking fine. You know, you have Alien Romulus, which might do some business. It might not. We'll see how much gas there is left in that tank. But right now, it's still, if you look at it holistically, the ticket sales are down about 16% compared to the same time of last year, which is, you know, significant when you consider it hadn't even recovered from pre-COVID times. So not pretty, but definitely signs of demand for certain movies that are working.
Yeah, and that gap's probably gonna grow because I mean we're now hitting the point of time last year when Barbenheimer dropped, which was obviously a huge box office boon. And there's gonna be, and you know, Deadpool Wolverine's gonna come out, and that's gonna, you know, counterbalance some of that this year. But it's gonna be, I think the end of year numbers are gonna be not great on a comparative basis.
Oh, no, definitely not. I mean, a lot of people have basically written off this year, and they're looking at 2025 and be like, aha, this is the year where we're
finally
seeing it. Yes, it's very much like the Dodgers will get them next year, that kind of thing.
Every year it's next year. That's
of course.
That's how it's been since COVID. But we'll see. The Long Legs story is fascinating. And look, I liked Long Legs. Okay, I thought it was pretty good. I'm always happy to see cheap horror movies do well because, you know, that is a foundational corner of the business. The thing I was most interested by is, you know, how to put this without sounding like I'm ripping on A24, but like this is one of the things that always drives me a little bit crazy about box office talk is people talk about like, oh, these A24 movies are doing so well. You know, A24, huge hit. And this movie comes out and it's probably going to gross, it grossed more than, it will end up grossing more than, what is it, X, Pearl, and Maxine combined, probably.
Yeah, which it'll be Hereditary, too, probably.
Yeah.
You know,
and
or
I
did
like,
its opening weekend, which is one of A24's biggest horror movies, if not its biggest. So
yeah, and this is again, it's not really a criticism of A24 because they're working at smaller levels and all that. But I feel like they suck up an inordinate amount of the oxygen in the indie film world. So it's nice to see Neon get their props for this and really really knock one out of the park.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to have more, good for the business to have more distributors that are doing well and making a name for themselves. I mean, the indie film world, as you know, right now, it's basically, you basically have two theatrical distributors that are of any note, and that's A24 and Neon. And A24 does take up a lot of the oxygen. They put out this release that said they are worth $3.5 billion now as a company, which, you know, I don't know, someone believes that, I'm sure. Whoever's putting money into the place believes that, but who knows? We have no idea really what Neon's valuation is, but I'm guessing it's nowhere near that. But they've had some success. A24 is just incredibly good at self-branding and knowing its audience, and really just, I mean, you see the Max deal that they did where HBO can go out and say, like, hey, we got a deal with A24 to show their movies, and that's like a big coup for us. Yay. So
we're the home of A24. Yeah.
We're the home of A24 on streaming.
Yeah.
So, you know, that is actually a calling card that you can cite if you're A24. So there you go. They've done a good job with that side of the business.
Yeah, and I'll say that, you know, look, one last little note here. This happened a little while ago, so I don't want to focus too much on it, but Sony buying the Drafthouse is another interesting element to all this, because the Drafthouse theaters are the places where movies like A24, movies distributed by A24, movies distributed by Neon overperform. They're you know, kind of hipper, younger theater chains. That's where you know, a lot of the audience shows up for this sort of thing. And I know there's some concern, there's some mild concern that Sony might, you know, monkey with that or change it, but it doesn't make any sense from a business. There's no point in buying. Yeah, there's no point in buying Alamo if you're gonna like not let them do Alamo things, right?
Yeah, I just don't buy the idea that Sony's gonna buy Alamo Drafthouse and turn it into like a PlayStation arcade or something like that. It just makes no sense. Like, the whole point of this, you could argue, was so they could bet on, or place a bigger bet on, the theatrical experience, which seems to be very important, you know, personally to Tom Rothman over at Sony, and, you know, certainly would be important to the sellers, Alamo and Tim League, who's still going to be a stakeholder. So I just don't see that happening. You know, it doesn't really make sense for Sony to change Alamo's programming in any way, other than maybe putting a few more Crunchyroll anime titles on the slate, or doing some big special events around Sony movies that they have, like, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But they did that. Alamo was doing that kind of thing anyway, and that's like part of the attraction. So, I don't know. I don't see.
All right. That was everything I wanted to ask. As you know, I like to close by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if there's anything you think folks should know about in the world of Hollywood business. What's going on?
Wow. We covered so much that I don't think I have anything left to talk about, amazingly enough, except for, well, I mean, every week there's a new story that the NBA rights deal is done or almost done, or that they're, you know, ironing out the paperwork, or they're faxing over, you know, the final signed copy of the deal. But, you know, we will take a breath and talk about that when the deal is actually done, because that has huge consequences for TNT, David Zaslav, and Warner Bros. Discovery.
Yeah, that's gonna be a real interesting shift there. If a shift does in fact happen, we'll see what happens with the rights deal there. All right, Ryan, thanks for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sonny. Good to talk to you again.
And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.